Welcome to All Things Cage at Waveforms Radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears. I'm your host, Laura Kuhn, Executive Director of the John Cage Trust, and my guest today is pianist Adam Tendler, an internationally recognized interpreter of living, modern, and classical composers. Adam is a pioneer of DIY culture and concert music, and at age 23, he performed solo recitals in all 50 United States as part of a grassroots tour he called America 88 by 50, which became the title and subject of his memoir, 88 by 50, a Kirkus Indie Book of the Month and a Lambda Literary Award nominee. Adam is an active presence in contemporary and classical music alike as a soloist, recording artist, speaker, and educator. He is also a leading John Cage interpreter and collaborates with the John Cage Trust and Edition Peters, Cage's longtime music publisher, in presenting Cage's work internationally. He recently released the album Robert Palmer Piano Music on New World Records and published his second book, Tide Pools. Welcome to All Things Cage, Adam. I have to say that in perusing international press about you in preparation for this conversation, I came up with an astonishing list of adjectives used to describe both you and your performances, which I just have to share. Probing, persuasive, intrepid, outstanding, discerning, ecstatic, brave, virtuosic, evangelical. What do you have to say to all that, I wonder?
It's always nice to hear that because whenever someone else said like that, especially if they're, you know, in the press, so to speak, it's nice to hear it. I think my nature always greets stuff like that with suspicion suspicion or cynicism, because I appreciate it, but I always just wonder about all of that. I mean, when I experience a funny sensation before I even go out onto any kind of concert stage, if I'm playing a recital or something, and there's this sense of disbelief that this is all happening and that I'm trusted to do such and such thing, which is usually playing the piano, which after 30 years of doing that, you know, I've started playing, my first experience with the piano was over 30 years ago, not professionally, but, you know, I've been playing piano professionally for like 20 years. You'd think I was like used to that by now, or that feeling of being trusted in that way.
I'm not sure that you ever will entirely. I'm not sure. Merce Cunningham once told me that we were talking about a film, The Talented Mr. Ripley. We were talking about
the film.
Yeah, and he kind of shuddered at the thought of it. And I said, you don't like that film? It's so cool. And he said, no, it's just the whole idea of like getting found out.
Wow.
And I said, what do you know about getting found out? You know, and he said he just sort of lived in this constant fear. He never knew why people liked him and what he did. And they could just as easily not like him and what he did. And he said he always lived on the kind of the edge of that feeling all the time, which I found amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty astonishing to hear because, you know, he'd been since the 50s, at least to some extent, I keep using that word trust, like trusted by people to present his work, you know, and I think we assume that artists take that trust and synthesize it in such a way that it comes out or manifests as confidence. And I just don't think it ever really totally works that way. That's really fascinating to hear. You know, I once was reading like what a certain self-help book, which is, you know, I have a hobby of doing that. And they didn't call it imposter syndrome. They called it the imposter experience, this author. And I thought that was really interesting because I think their point was that this is like a very universal experience. It's not a syndrome like an illness or a dysfunction. It's something that people experience all the time in different ways. For me, like when I'm presenting or preparing a recital or a big thing or whatever, it's interesting that gnawing fear of being found out is part of that process. It's like, well, if I don't prepare this thing, then everyone will find out, which I find really interesting that, again, after decades of doing this, that they're still like, oh, well, now that I'm on this tightrope and if I fall, everything up to this point will have meant nothing and I will,
right,
you know.
It'll just disappear. It'll disappear.
Right. But it's funny that you bring up that film just because I think of that film, when I saw that film, I was really startled by the depiction of, Matt Damon's character in terms of his obsession and in terms of his true like love for the Jude Law character. And I could really relate to that. And before talking to you, and not to pathologize anything, but I think that was why I shuddered when I saw that movie, is because I thought, oh my gosh, I really identify with the person who is not the protagonist of this movie. That's the person who I totally get. And when I think of that movie, I think of this moment when, or just moments, not to make this about Talented Mr. Ripley, but there's moments where he oversteps those boundaries. There's a moment, for instance, when he like gets into the bathtub with
Right.
the
I was just
person.
going to say,
And
must be leading up to the
the
bathtubs.
bathtub, and I just remember that bathtub moment was like, to me, something I could really relate to, of being like, oh no, I overstepped. I violated some boundaries that I wasn't aware of. And again, like maybe now I'm going to be found out. And found out for whatever that, even found out for being so amorous. Before talking to you today, and again, so I don't mean this in any pathological or pathologizing way, but like when I'm reading, I was reading some of Love Icebox, the collection of letters from Cage to Cunningham during the 40s, which for listeners, which you edited and published, is it last year?
No, it was 2019, right?
Okay, yeah, so again, but when I read those letters and I read how amorous and on it, I mean, and I don't mean any of these in negative words, but, or in negative connotations, but obsessive and truly kind of digging out the self that Cage was and sort of offering it to Cunningham as he was in these letters, I find a sort of sense of affinity, maybe a sense of solace also.
Sure. Let me interrupt you, Adam, very briefly to inform the listeners what we're doing here. So while Adam's going to grace us with a bit of music later in the program, recorded, of course, we've come together today really in celebration of Valentine's Day this year. And we're going to be talking a lot about my most recent book, which is called Love Icebox, Letters from John Cage to Merce Cunningham, which was published by the John Cage Trust. Like me, Adam is a great fan of this collection. So we decided that it might be a nice treat for us to talk about what we loved about the book. So, Adam, you've touched on one thing, which is really not only evident in the letters, but surprising to a lot of people to discover Cage's obsession and his fragility around the notion of relationship and monogamy.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, there's parts in this book, because as I was sort of rereading it, the first time I read through it, I was really, again, I kind of have to use the word startled, just by how frank Cage is in these letters about his feelings, and especially this sense of misery, of loneliness, of I'm not, this sense of him not even being sure of what else is left of him because he's given so much away. And almost like a willingness to saying, well, I'm happy to have done that, but now I don't know what's left of me. And this is something that I mean, I can relate to. I think whenever we're experiencing even new love or new infatuation, that thrill can be met with that same fear of what am I risking here? How I've made myself vulnerable, is that a mistake? And it's something that we see, I think, Cage wrestling with in these letters. And I mean, one of the elephant in the room of the book is that we're not really seeing Merce's responses.
I know, isn't that interesting that we're really reading their relationship through one side of the couple? It's obvious that Merce responded. So for those listening who don't are not really aware of the book, the letters are just John Cage to Merce Cunningham. It's clear that Cunningham responded. Letters say, "Oh my God, a new letter from you today. I'm just going to roll around on it for a while." Really very impassioned things like that. But those letters are nowhere to be found. I kind of had hope that Merce Cunningham had given them to somebody close to him, and that when the book came out, somebody would go, "Ha ha! Here they are!" But no one has come forward. No one has come forward. So I suppose it's quite possible that he destroyed them, because it does, as you say, probably on both sides, reveal something of a very tenderness in both of them. And as I used the word before, but I think it stands as fragility in allying yourself so intently or so intensely with another person.
Yeah, it's funny because there's parts in the book where Cage says, you know, even if you just lie to me and tell me that you're going to come, because then I'll have a reason to, I'll have something to look forward to, even if it's not real. You can disappoint me later, but I can get through. It's what I find really interesting is this sort of day to day, how can I get through today kind of sense of Cage's life at the time. And he says he's exhausted just going, he's exhausting himself with movies. He's exhausting himself with
work.
He's drinking too much. And in that sort of pendulum swinging between, I'm grateful for the work, this is my inspiration, you are my muse, you are the channel, all of my notes are for you, that sort of gratitude. But then at the other side, and he'll say, then we come to this sort of complete boulder of loneliness, impasse, where he's completely non-functional and actually just trying to stay busy, just to sort of get through the day, to make sure he can function into the next day. Another thing that strikes me through whenever I read, I guess we could have to call these historical letters, but I just finished playing a big Schumann program, and I was reading a lot of, you know, Schumann's letters to Clara. And this is like a very, weirdly very similar kind of a situation of uncertain love, of a future that's uncertain. And of course, you know, the Schumann love triangle is what it became. But like the Clara Schumann, or, you know, and Robert Schumann, they, you know, theirs is another one of the famous love affairs of music. And when one reads their letters, there's that same kind of thread of fear of, where is this going? Like, I love you so much, but I don't know where this is leading. And one thing that strikes me whenever I read those letters, and it's so different from how we all communicate now, is, and I know this is so kind of trite and very like sort of a nitty gritty thing, is, but there's always this lag. There is, now we just send an email or send a text or make a phone call, and we can sort of at least move the ball a little bit, get the ball rolling. And this is all very obvious, but it's really interesting, this element that we see in Cage's letters here, but also even in Clara Schumann and Robert Schumann, is this element of waiting. And that's a Cage piece called Waiting, you know, like this idea of waiting, and what is happening while I wait?
Right,
and what is
right.
this silence? You know, Cage writes one letter, it's been a week since I've heard from you. And
I interpret this?
How do I interpret this? And like, if I can, this is, you and I are friends, and I confess to you all the time. There's versions of that now. I've had a conversation very similarly recently where I was just like, why didn't I hear from you for 6 hours? You know what I mean? So everything's relative, right? So it's like, so were you not thinking of me for 6 hours? That kind of thing, which can seem so crazy, actually, lack of better words. You can sort of see that if you're waiting for a week or 2 weeks or longer.
Right. Do you remember when you were a teenager? I don't know what your love life was when you were, you know, a very young guy in your teens. But do you remember ever being absolutely devastated by the rejection of a partner?
Yes and no, because everything is and this is an element that's interesting when I'm reading this book too, or when I read through Love Icebox in these letters, the strong feelings of love that I had as a teenager had to be hidden because I was gay, and I don't even think I knew that yet. I just knew what my feelings were, and they were definitely for people of the same sex. So there was like all these things compounded on top of each other. There was the obsession and a sense of, you know,
hiding.
Love and obsession, but also compounded with hiding and shame and secrecy, which can also be a fuel. That can be sexy too, and erotic, is having a secret and having something that's hidden. That can be very, very seductive as well. But, you know, in high school, I sort of would have a fixation. I had my one fixation, which was haunts me to this day, was this person who I had a very, very close bond with. And what ended up happening, the irony is, I think this person was It was very much, what's the word I'm looking for? Require. It was a back and forth. They were giving it to me as
It
well.
was requited.
It was requited.
I guess I don't know that you can say that, but that's what you mean.
I'm trying to think of what the word. There is a word for that. But
Reciprocal,
reciprocate.
reciprocal.
Yeah, it was reciprocated and intensely so. But what was interesting about this, and not to go into the weeds of my sad history, is that people in my school, it was a very high school situation. This was in Vermont, for our listeners. So it also wasn't an urban cosmopolitan setting where people are used to this kind of, maybe more used to, gay relationships or whatever. And this was also like not even 2000 yet. So things change, and things I think culturally have changed really fast in the last couple decades. But anyway, people started to whisper about us. And what's interesting is I actually was the one who had set up boundaries for my own fear in that relationship to actually make sure that it was like not necessarily requited, if you catch my drift. I kind of kept things pretty platonic, even though those feelings were there. What's interesting is this person ended up seeing this gossip and then they dropped me. And it was really devastating because suddenly I was like, oh. And suddenly I was like the Mr. Ripley character where I'm like, oh my God, I'm the one? Like, that really was traumatizing in high school because I sort of had to pick up the piece again. It was like, well, what's left of me? I've given a lot here. I've actually dropped my actual friends in exchange for this relationship, which now just went up in flames. That haunted me. But everything's kind of weird in sort of when we actually have to bring in the element of being gay and being closeted. So a lot of the things I think that even people might experience in high school in terms of rejection and heartbreak, I was experiencing in my 20s, like late, because I didn't really come out until I was 25. And again, if I can be really frank, I'm experiencing them like literally now, like all the time. And it's kind of like, wait, I'm in my late 30s. I'm supposed to like, but even just before we started talking, I started thinking of even Cage's age. We think of this as such a youthful period. I'm thinking, well, he's in his 30s here. It's
Yeah,
not, he's not,
young
he's
30.
not, yeah, young 30s, but he's not a child. You know what I mean? And so that, again, as someone who is sort of a student of Cage's music lifelong and always, when every time I'm playing a piece of his, feel like I'm, experiencing a musical side of him and I have a musical attraction to Cage, it's actually really comforting to sometimes have these like very personal moments of affinity with him on a very personal level. So when I was thinking about his age and thinking of sort of his vulnerability and his fear and his quickness, the book ends for listeners, I don't want to give away the ending, but it ends really with him sort of relinquishing, saying this is it.
He says
That
goodbye. He says, I don't
Yeah.
know how, I don't know what I did, but
Right.
it's over.
And that quickness to saying, I can't do this is also, I don't know, I'm saying the word quickness, but that willingness to say, this is too much for me. I don't know even what's left of me. And I don't know, there's not a room, I love the line, there's not a room small enough for me to be in. That feeling, that readiness of that feeling is something that, of course, is so heartbreaking, but it's also comforting to me, because I'm like, oh, again, I'm not reading the letters of a teenager. I'm reading the letters of a 30-something year old who's trying to figure out love, who's trying to navigate love. You brought up the issues of monogamy, which I thought was really interesting, because sometimes the letters really do get into the nitty-gritty. And I actually have a passage here.
Go
Can I
for it.
read some of
Yes, of course.
it? Because again, that nitty-grittiness of like, okay, well, what are the terms here? Like, what are the terms and conditions is something I found really interesting because it's so contemporary. And it's so contemporary. Yeah, it's just such a contemporary thing. This is one of the last letters. And it's so 1946. So he was around 34-ish. He says, I have a ghastly amorous problem. I don't know what to do. And that is why I must tell you about it. It is not your problem, it is mine. But perhaps you will be able to write something that will bring balm. By the way, Laura, I've literally texted things like this during lockdown. I'm not kidding. It's this idea of it's not you, it's me. It's not your problem, it's mine. I have to figure this out, and I'm really sorry for putting it on you. I'm
Yes,
really
but
sorry. But
however,
however, now
it
that I've got you
requires
here.
you. It requires you to help me through this.
Totally. And I love that this is sort of the Valentine's program because this is what it's like when we're navigating love. It's sort of that idea of like, all right, this is a lot of this is me, but I need you to sort of navigate the interfaces with me. So he
Go
goes
ahead.
on. I have nightmares and can't sleep and am in general nocturnal misery. I am worried that maybe you don't love me and that you will love other misters. I know you love me as artist, friend, and spirit, but I am afraid that it is I who always forces sex. I am in erotic doubt. I know you love freedom. I don't know how much I mean to you as sex or whether you simply tolerate me. I love you and I want to be faithful to you. I don't know whether you want to be faithful to me or whether you would even consider my possessiveness. Nothing is more desirable to me than the feeling of being possessed by you, but I don't know whether you like to be possessed by me. He later says, I spend hours wondering how you are in bed with someone else and whether you give more to others than to me. Selfish of me, no doubt, but then, and then he goes on and tells a story.
It's so beautiful, Adam. It's so beautiful, isn't it? Because it's
It's,
so
yeah.
revealing. It's just revealing of his own. I don't even know what to call it. You know, it's not weakness. It's a kind of humanity.
Yeah, and again, a lot of these words, that's a beautiful word for it, is humanity. And a lot of words can have a negative connotation. Like if I was to say insecurity, that seems negative. But because insecurity can be so universal, I don't think of it as a negative thing. I mean, when he says something like, I spend hours, whether you give more to others than to me, well, what are you comfortable telling someone else that you can't tell me? Who else makes you laugh if they're not me? You know, like that kind of thing. So even that universality of this, it's really more about intimacy to me and the fear of like, well, I'm happy to give all of myself to you. And I doubt that from you. If I could just say, this letter just rocks my world. He says, I want to know how you feel, for generally you keep your feelings secret. Seems to me that you love me more nowadays. God knows my love for you has grown and grows continually, so that it is with me always and in every place my spirit is. The thought of your body near me is heaven. I'll stop there. But again, that idea of like, I'm telling you so much, you don't tell me very much, which again is that just such an interesting element in the structure of the book, which because we don't know what he's saying. And goodness knows if we saw it, I wonder if it would be all that much, because it seems like Cage seems to be struggling with the responses.
Yes, I knew both men very well. I mean, in turn, really. I knew John very well, and I didn't really get to know Merce very well until John was gone. So then Merce and I, you know, flatmates off and on for I don't know what, 15 years, something like that. My point is really that the letters were not surprising from that point of view for me. That Merce was, he did not bare his soul easily. It was a sort of constant complaint of his dancers. They didn't know what he was thinking. You see that in Carolyn Brown's book a lot, where she's just really riddled with anxiety at times over the silence of this character. And he was very much like that with Cage. So that was not surprising. What was surprising was that John was so emotional, you know, that he was so fragile in his love life. Now, I saw that in real life between the two of them later in their lives. They had been together for a very, very long time. I don't know about you, but I don't have any relationships of that intensity that have gone on for 50 years, you know?
Totally,
Number one, I'm
exactly.
not quite old enough, but you know, I'm approaching it, and it's not going to happen. You know, it's too late for me to have that. So that was what was shocking. But I want to point out something very sweet in that letter that you probably don't know. And that is in moments of intimacy, Merce referred to John as Mr.
Oh,
Just Mr.
interesting.
That's like a, that was like a fondness. And on his deathbed, when John was dying, literally, he was never awakened from a coma that took place after his stroke. Merce and I got to go say goodbye to John together.
Oh my
In the
God.
hospital room. No, it was good.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh wow, I didn't realize this ever happened this episode.
I was working with John the day that he had his stroke. I had left to go down to Andy Culver's apartment where I was staying. Andy was out in the country with, I think, his girlfriend at the time. And I got a phone call very shortly after I got to Andy's apartment from Mimi Johnson, who said, John's collapsed and he's had a stroke and the paramedics are with him. Can you come back? So Andy's place was in Soho. So I ran back up to John's, really just in time to have the stretcher meet me sort of mid-body as I was coming in the building. He was being carried out of the building. He never recovered from that. Right. But because they had put him on life support because he didn't have a DNR, a do not resuscitate thing in place, they had put him on life support. He lived for another, whatever that was, 20 hours or so. Once they realized that, Marissa and I went to the hospital, we were both on Cage's power of whatever you call that, medical power of attorney or whatever it's called. And they took him off it, but then they had to wait a certain period of time before they pulled plugs. So they took him off of drugs, they did all that, but they couldn't actually unplug him. And so they came in and asked us, would we like to say goodbye before they did that? And Merce said, will you come with me? And so we got to do that together, which was very, very, very moving. He looked so beautiful, Cage did, on the precipice, if you will, of his death. He looked so heroic. I remember walking into the emergency room or the ICU emergency and seeing all these people roughly his age, he was 79, who looked like they weren't gonna last one more second. You know, they were so ill. And there was Cage looking rather leontine. Hair was falling back from his face. He was lying there. He had a white sheet, but his shoulders and his neck were bare. He just looked so heroic or something. But I remember Merce saying to him, goodbye, mister, and putting his hand on touching his shoulder. It was very moving. And then we went back to that room. I'll tell you the end of the story. We went back to the consult room where he and I were being housed, and the doctors went to pull the plug at that point. And Merce and I just sat there a little uncomfortable, not being together, just uncomfortable with what was going on. And the doctors came back in no more than 5 minutes later. They walked back in and the doctor sat down and he said, your friend is gone, that you just need to know that we walked in to disengage him from the machinery and his heart fluttered and simply stopped. So we never actually did that. So, which was extremely meaningful to Merce and I. We both felt very much like John had waited for us to just say goodbye. Everything was complete. It's like he waited for us to get not comfortable with the idea, but at least in the idea that he might be leaving. And then he left. It was really just as simple as that. And we didn't actually have to pull the plug, if you know what I mean. Right. He did it himself. Yeah, right. It was heroic. And it made me, I remember feeling that maybe this isn't true for everybody, but in his case, it was hard to die. You know, right. That everything in the body doesn't want to leave. It's not, you know, it's hard to just stop, for things to stop. And I felt very proud of him, like he had done this heroic thing, this amazing thing.
Laura, I did not know that yet at all.
Yeah.
That he, you know, a lot of like the biographies, and we've talked a bit about this, is that, you know, I never met him and know him just through his friends and his allies and his colleagues. And of course, written words, you know, his biographies and so on. And so many of them stop with his discovery in the 18th Street loft of having suffered the stroke, and they stopped there. I never realized that there was that kind of epilogue of him actually at the hospital and with you in the room and with Merce in the room.
He went on for 20 hours because, so I left him at something like, I don't know what it was. Merce generally came home from the studio between 6 and 6:30, and he liked the apartment empty. He didn't want guests there. He didn't want me there. He didn't want anybody there. So he would come home. He would take a bath. He was usually cranky when he got home because he had been working with the dancers all day. So I left. It had to be like around 5:30. Mm-hmm. And John was listless that day. He was just couldn't really focus on anything well. And he, when I left him, he, well, I won't tell you the most intimate thing, but when I left, I was going to, but it's probably not appropriate. But
I think you once told me.
His anyway. Red boxer shorts.
Yeah.
He had, all right, fine. He had zipped his red boxer shorts into his, or they were briefs actually, into the zipper of his jeans. Right. And he was asking me if I could help him get it undone. And I did try. I mean, we were close. And I said, you know, I have to go. So I'm going to go and you go in the bathroom and take these both off, because then you'll be able to do it on your lap. You won't be trying to curl yourself into a pretzel to get this out. But when I left him, he was making tea for Merce, iced tea, because it was summer. It was a late summer. It was hot. And Mimi must have called me, I don't know, half hour later, maybe. So sometime between my leaving and Merce's coming home, John collapsed. So that would have been around 6, that when he actually had his stroke. And then he was carted off to the hospital very quickly, and he died around 2 in the afternoon the next day. So it was almost exactly 20 hours that he hovered for a while before he actually left. It was very.
Do you remember the hospital?
Yeah, it was St. Vincent's down on 14th.
Wow, yeah. Which is no longer.
Exactly. 7th Avenue. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. It was very meaningful. But I wanted to say, let's return to love letters, because
I know, but sorry. I know, but can I say one more? Because this is one thing when I was reading your epilogue in the book that I thought was so, I actually don't want to spoil the ending for readers, because I mean, even just rereading it today, I thought of like 10 people I need to send this book to, because it's just so gorgeous. But your epilogue is so gorgeous, and about Merce's behavior that night. And I won't get into what he does that night, which actually almost like brought me to tears rereading it just now. But two sentences that really struck me about your experience with Merce that night, which can go back to this idea of their love and their life together, is you write, Merce talked to me more in the first few days after Cage's death than he had in 6 years. And I thought that was really interesting. And then you go on and say, I remember vividly his behavior on that first evening. In the hours just after Cage died, he was distraught, contemplating a life without activity in the house. And now I'm paraphrasing to say that he seemed to think no one would be visiting anymore.
Yeah.
But that the house was now empty of life.
Right.
I wanted to ask you about that, about what that first, because I remember when my father passed away last year, there was something really raw and surreal about those first days, but especially the first night. And I remember my first night when I found out my father, it's just strange. You go into sort of an adrenaline rush, and it's not the despair, I think, that for many of us, it's not the despair that we're expecting. And I'm just curious about your experience in those days and how that might have also just sort of fleshed out possibly your impression of their life together.
I don't actually know how to answer that exactly. You know, Merce was far less verbal than John was. So John was really the host in the apartment. John created the dinner parties, which, by the way, Merce used to complain about bitterly, because he liked solitude. He liked, you know, quiet. So he didn't like, he would come home. I was there frequently when he did come home, and he'd say, John would be cooking, and he'd say, who's coming to dinner? And John would be so excited, and he would say, this biologist or this filmmaker, or because he could speak to almost anybody about their work and his own work, and Merce would be unhappy. It was just startling to me that Merce would get forlorn about that now that John had died, that was going to stop, when all he tended to do was complain about, you know. So, but that's very relationship. It's very, you know, it's nothing strange. But Merce was social. I mean, he was a social person, but kind of one-on-one. He wasn't really a party person so much. It was always, I remember cooking dinners for him and guests. And it was always a very important thing who was going to get to sit on Merce's right and who was going to be on his left, because he would stay put And that would be his conversation primarily. And so that was really important. It's also important in terms of the guests, because if you didn't put so-and-so next to Merce, they would pout all night, or they would leave early, or they, you know, would somehow feel slighted. Anyway.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, I really got to know Merce after that. I mean, I really didn't know him very well. He was protected. He was very protective of his space. He just was not like John. You know, John, I never experienced that. That kind of self-doubt, kind of insecurity about critics, for example. Merce would rant when he got a bad review, and John would laugh at him and say, oh, Merce, for heaven's sakes, don't be so dramatic, you know?
Did he talk about, what did he get, again, not to go keep going back to when Cage passed away, but did he seem reminiscent of older, of that sort of mythical origin times of like the, you know, the early days of the company or the early days of that meeting? Or was, did he seem still very much in the moment of 1992 in those?
Who? Merce?
Merce in the days after, because
he went to, he went back to the dance studio the next day. So he was occupying himself, you know. Well, I mean, there's so many things I could tell you about that, but he was a survivor. You know, Merce was very much a survivor. He knew how to take care of himself, for better or worse, you know, but he knew how to do that. And this was no different. So he left me. I'll tell you a kind of cute story is that the day after John Cage died, I was at the loft and Merce had gone to the studio. And so it was quiet. And the next thing I know, there's a knock on the door, which itself was shocking because the door was a, you had to ring to get into the building, and nobody had done that, but somebody was knocking on the front, on the apartment door. So I opened the door and this woman walks in. I didn't know her from Adam. She walks in and she says, oh, hello, hello, hello. I'm just here to get some clothes. And I said, who are you? And she said, oh, I'm sorry. My name is MC Richards. And I'm a good friend of John and Merce's, and I've come to get some of John's clothing. I know he passed away yesterday, and I'd like to go through his clothes.
Wow.
So she immediately went to the closet, stripped down to her undies, and started trying things on and sort of talking to herself. So I very quietly went in the next room, and I called Merce at the studio, which you just, that was a no-no to begin with. You weren't to do that. But I called him at the studio, and I, you know, very quietly kind of said, there's a woman here. She said her name is MC Richards, and she's trying on John's clothes, and she's stacking things up. And he burst out laughing, and he said, oh, isn't she marvelous? Ah. And that was it. Now, it turned out that MC Richards, who you know, was a very famous potter and a writer.
Right.
Anyway, she had come over because she lived at the Camp Hill home in Camp Hill, Pennsylvania, and it housed two different kinds of people, really, people who were handicapped in one way or another, lived at Camp Hill, and people who were not handicapped, but who had something that they could contribute to the community. And MC used to say that being a potter, she was so needed because the people at Camp Hill mostly would break her dishes and she would be needed to make more dishes. But anyway, she was trying on clothes for all the people at Camp Hill. And she took back a whole stack of jeans that she thought would fit Henry or Sarah, or shirts.
Oh, jacket. Wow.
Yeah. And MC, and Merce said, isn't it cute? Merce Cunningham, MC Richard.
Yeah.
He said, oh, isn't she marvelous? She can take whatever she wants. You know.
Interesting. That's amazing.
Yeah. But Merce was very happy to be back in the studio. It was his life. It was his purpose. That had happened to Cage didn't mean that came to an end in any way.
And I think that thread, even of balancing or using work as sort of a vessel for the relationship, is something that, of course, we could argue was a thread of their relationship later in life, of course, because they're working together all the time. And Cage calling the studio and, you know, he's interfacing professionally for and with Merce all the time.
Adam, the one really important part of that, what you're saying is that John was the mediator for the problems at the studio. So whenever anything happened, fights broke out or arguments or disagreements of any kind or tussles, Mercer would bring them home and dump them on John, and then he'd go take a bath whistling. And John had to hold the office and, you know, admonish whoever had done what, you know, during the day. So that ended. And there were repercussions for that, absolutely, after the fact.
Yeah.
I'm sure John was just tired. That I remember thinking, okay, we'll all behave. You can come back now. Like, we were all asking too much of him, you know, that we were asking too much.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, but even in the first letters where they're talking about translations and they're, you know, which is still like work, it's still a gig, or they're gigging in a way, translating literature, or even just some of the first musical works. So a lot of the subject of Cage's letters to Cunningham in those days are keeping him abreast of his music.
And they're working together, Adam. Remember, they're working together over many letters on...
A Book of Music.
A Book of Music. Well, that Cage is working on A Book of Music. But there's
Four Walls. Four Walls is a big part of it, too. And what's also funny is that Cage will sometimes be asking in these... Again, we only have Cage's side of things, but he'll keep asking, how is Four Walls? Oh, I'm so glad Four Walls is going well. He's sort of, how is our piece? And so one thing I find really striking about the letters, and it was really fun to go through it with a highlighter, because it'll just kind of tra-la-la, very workaday stuff. How's the piece? This, here's my, and then it'll say like, need you desperately. Na 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 na. And it's just, and then it just goes on with all the other stuff. Again, that's so relatable, because it's just like a that stream of it all being mixed together and everything coming out at once. I'd like to know about this. I need you to know I need you desperately. Also, so-and-so's coming over tomorrow.
Your social security check arrived today.
Yeah, I need to, you know, the tailor wasn't, you know, the shoe person wasn't there to figure out your shoe situation. I can't breathe because there's no air in the room because you're not here.
No, it's absolutely true. And, you know, I find a certain consistency in Cage's letters, that the charm that we come to know in his writings, you know, I only knew him in the last decade of his life, really. So, but the charm of his writings throughout his life are absolutely evident in the letters. You know, he's charming. He is incredibly funny. I remember in one of the letters in the earlier book that I did is called The Selected Letters of John Cage, which are letters, again, only Cage out, but across 50 years and to people of all walks of life, strangers, loved ones, et cetera. And I remember just little things in those letters, like went to Les Halles today. He was in Paris. When the farmer's market was just opening, the carrots smelled so good. I wished I were a rabbit. He was just charming. You know, there was something so lovable about him. And that comes through even through his anguish in this relationship. And going back to the end of the book, when you were saying, you know, it's so touching and so tragic when Cage says, it's over. I'll try to figure out what I did. I don't know what I said, but it's over. That, you know, they would go on to have another, you know, 40 years together.
Right. Well,
actually more than that, you know, almost 50 years together after that.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, I definitely want to say something about that too. But another thing that's so interesting in the letters collected in Love Icebox is the variety of ways in which he can express, I mean, agony is one thing and misery and loneliness is one thing, but also just pure, like a rush of love. You know, to say the rain reminds me of you, the air reminds me of you, the way, and I'm saying it very unpoetically, but the way that he terms it from letter to letter of using very natural imagery, it's like, it's complete poetry.
I know.
And it comes out of nowhere. And that's what's actually so nice, is that it's like a flowing stream. You'll get this very, you know, stuff about what's going on that week. And then you just get this complete like bouquet of a sentence that just is if one person said that once to me in my life, I think I'd be done. I'd be okay. I'd be set for life. And each letter, there's just such variety of ways to say, in essence, the same thing of I love you.
I think, though, I can see, was it you that told me? It was one of my friends who is also gay, but it might have been you who said something like, if I had a lover in the early stages of our relationship and he behaved like that, I'd kick him to the curb. Oh, no, probably, no. I don't know who it was. It wasn't me.
Yeah. But I kick him
to the curb. He's like a hug addict, you know?
Yeah, it's not me. I would love that. As, in fact, it's like, because that's the thing. This is, I think that Cage or, you know, not to go into confession mode, but like, or me, it's that sort of, and maybe there's an attraction to being that yin and yang, or I'm this way and I'm attracted to that work of trying to crack the code of this other person who is so not giving me this. And again, that kind of, there's several threads through these letters from Cage to Cunningham, and there is the one of just complete banquet of love, one of loneliness, and then one of just doubt, you know? And I don't know. I've wondered about that with myself from time to time. It was like, is that Trinity something that I just always need, you know? And it's interesting that that sort of fuels Cage's, even his creativity during this period. Like he's prolific during this period. He's creating these incredible works, but we get a glimpse in these letters of those three constant things. But no, I mean, I would love to have this from It wasn't
That's a very, very nice summation. We need to wrap up shortly. We have maybe a minute.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I know. It just flies by, doesn't it? I feel yes. that way. Anytime I do a conversation for this program, I just feel like it just
I know.
Flies by.
And you and I have so much fun. Is there something you wanted to say in the last minute? Because there was something I wanted to say.
I'll say mine and then you say yours. I was just going to say, for our listeners, the book, we've really focused on the emotional aspects of the book, which is really the most striking thing, I think, about the letters. But I'm also taken with the few letters in the book wherein John shares what he's thinking about with music, what he's thinking about rhythm, that he's missing his confidant, he's missing his sounding board, his muse, right, as he puts it. And there are beautiful things about melody. Anybody who thinks that John Cage was an unemotional sort needs to get their hands on this book.
You know, I agree with you.
Not just relationship-wise, but when he's talking about music as well. We're looking at melody. We're looking at rhythm and what makes it expressive and how to help it be expressive. I find it all very, very, very enlightening.
Oh, and he writes in one sentence, he says that a certain piece of certain music is, it's like a scherzo in paradise, he writes. No, it's, and there's this one part, and I know we have no time, but he starts talking about his music and then he says, you know, I don't want to talk about, I'm paraphrasing, I don't want to talk about this in terms of movements. You know, that's so dreadful. Like, let me tell you what really happens. And he says, the sustaining pedal goes down sometimes on one piano, creating an atmosphere for the other to move in. And just before the end of this part, everything rises and floats and then settles into a gentle single spot. And he goes by measure, this super poetic, like he's in a trance talking about how wonderful this music is. And then my favorite part of this whole thing, he's saying this lasts for 2 minutes and this goes, and he goes, and then you are where I am. And I just love that sentence. And then he goes on and says, and then this happens with the tempo. But I found that passage so incredible because he is just like in a rapture state talking about his music in very florid, beautiful language. And he's just loving that he's creating this experience for someone. And I love that sentence of, and then you are where I am.
Yeah, yeah.
And who knows what that means? Maybe he's talking about mercy, might be talking about the listener. But I just find, I agree with you that I actually showed that passage to some composer friends of mine because I said, this is what it's about. This is what we're all doing this for.
I agree. And I, you know, sitting where I sit in life at the Cage Trust, you know, I hear a lot of opinions about John Cage and about the way he was and what's reflected in his music and, you know, and I can't tell you how many people think that he was so sort of abstract in his being and so separated. And he wasn't at all. You know, he was extremely connected to the world. He bore the weight of the world on his shoulders. He felt more deeply than most people I know, you know, in terms of just the world and what was going on in it. And music, you know, for him was a transformational thing. It was something that was not only going to change his way of thinking, but it was going to change you, Adam, as a player. And it was going to change you, Laura, as a listener. you know, we're all going to go through this transformation together. Right. So it was deadly serious for him. Music was deadly serious.
Right. And the power of it. And the last thing I'll say is that that idea of the charm that we see in his letters here in Love Icebox in the 40s, and that we see in later letters, you know, in the in your other collection. When you were saying that, I started thinking of, you know, that charm that we can find and that excitement that we find in the prepared piano music, let's say from the 40s, where I guess it might be a little more explicit, like we can see what's funny and charming. And that thread I find carries through to the music that other people might say is so abstract, because those situations, even if he's constructing a situation for you to be in, are usually very charming and very and so full of life. Or the circumstances that might lead to a chance determined piece are so interesting and charming, and the process is so like fascinating that I find that that charm and that personality, and that's why I usually tell people who, you know, we get criticisms all the time about his music, is people might just be looking sort of not at one, I don't know, it's, I just encourage people to find that charm and to actually look for him in all of these pieces, because he puts himself into all these pieces in a very vulnerable, intimate, personal way, I find, even those later, you know, especially those later pieces.
We really have to stop. It's been a pleasure, as always, to talk to you, Adam. I hope
you too, Laura.
Again, and we'll just talk about nothing but music. Are you going to send me a Valentine out of season?
I will be delighted to.
Please do. Please do.
Thank you for having me on. It's so fun to talk to you always.
It was a great pleasure. See you soon.
Bye.
Bye. So on to a bit of music. On June 10th, 1949, while on their first extended sojourn in Europe together, John Cage and Merce Cunningham gave a late afternoon presentation of music and dance at the Paris Atelier of Jean Helion, a French painter whose abstract work of the 1930s had established him as a leading modernist. Cunningham asked Tanaquil Leclerc and Betty Nichols, two members of Balanchine's Ballet Society in New York, who were on holiday in Paris, to join him on the salon stage. One of the two new dances that Cunningham made for the occasion was a Fusion avant l'heure, a trio set to John Cage's A Valentine Out of Season for solo prepared piano, which Cage had composed years earlier in 1944. The dance's title, a rough translation of the title of Cage's music, was later changed to Games when the dance was presented in New York, and later to simply Trio. Cage's music is itself loosely a trio, a suite of three short pieces, each quite distinct, the middle one dance-like. Overall, it is quite simple, as is the preparation of the piano. Cage wrote this piece at the turbulent start of his relationship with Merce Cunningham, and it is nearly synchronous with his separation from his wife, Xenia, to whom he had been married since 1935 and to whom the work is dedicated. A Valentine Out of Season is short and sweet and a favorite among pianists. It's been recorded by many, including Stefan Schleiermacher, Aki Takahashi, Philip Vondre, and Giancarlo Simonacci. What we'll listen to this evening is a recording made especially for us by none other than this week's guest, Adam Tendler, in celebration of this year's Valentine's Day, which is tomorrow.